commuted to Tour de France.
So I'd like to thank the organizers for inviting me to this beautiful corner of our continent and talk about some work, parts of which are getting a little long in the tooth by now, but are an interesting and useful way of exploring some of the properties of D-brains. As Amanda said in her talk, we've become accustomed to learning about string theory by taking various extreme limits in which the dynamics and the kinematics simplifies. And the particular limit that I'll be exploring in this talk is the limit of large Nivea-Schwartz B field. And what that helps us do is to take a kind of a field theoretic limit of string theory, where we get to keep some of the rudiments of stringy behavior, in particular a kind of a non-locality which manifests itself in an infrared ultraviolet correspondence, and a version of T-duality, not strictly T-duality, but some remnant of it, and yet in the context of a field theory limit of string theory. And so what's happening is that in this limit of large B field, the field theory is a field theory on a non-commutative space, and the non-commutativity parameter sets a scale in the theory, which is somewhat similar to the string scale, both as a regulator and a source of non-locality. Now, since learning about D-brains through the work of Polchinski, we have further learned that D-brains have, the charges carried by D-brains are not classified by homology or cohomology, but rather by K-theory. And that's simply because there are gauge theories, there are, if you like, vector bundles living on the brains. And furthermore, in the last year or so, through the work of Sen and Harvey and Krauss and others, we've learned that D-brains can be described as solitons in open string field theory. And that becomes particularly apparent, as we'll see in coming transparencies, when we take this large B field limit. Then we have a field theory and a rather simple description of D-brains as a kind of a soliton in that field theory arises. Part of the simplification is that the algebra of functions on the space on which the field theory is built becomes a non-commutative C-star algebra, and what we'll see is that the D-brains are simply projection operators. The soliton field configurations, if you like, are projection operators in that algebra. So let's begin. And people who know about non-commutativity and string theory can take a quick nap. So let's begin just with the world sheet Lagrangian of string theory. The low energy fields are, as usual, closed string fields of the metric and the B field living on the bulk of the world sheet, and a gauge field living on the boundary. For constant B, we can integrate by parts and push the action of the B field onto the boundary, where it appears in the same way as a constant F mu nu field for the boundary gauge field would. Now, in the presence of the large constant B field or equivalently large magnetic field coupling to the world sheet boundary, one has in the dynamics a kind of an equivalent of the Hall effect, That is, if we have an open string which is, say, moving in some direction with some velocity, then there's a coupling to the endpoints of the string, which are like the coupling, which act like charged particles now in a magnetic field. And so different charges get pushed in opposite direction, and that gets compensated then by having the stretching of the string. So the length to which the string stretches is just proportional to the velocity and the magnetic field strength. Now, if we then go a little further with the dynamics, the momentum, canonical momentum, is simply related to the velocity and the magnetic field. Boundary conditions at the end of the string are the standard Neumann-type boundary conditions in the presence of the B field. And so solving these two conditions, we get that the velocity is simply related to the momentum, but through a through a matrix which involves the strength of the magnetic field. So if we take the limit, which we are going to, of a large magnetic field, then the length to which the string stretches is proportional to the momentum it carries by a factor of the inverse of the magnetic field. The next simple consequence is that if we look at three strings interacting, they're little dipoles which are stretched proportional to the momentum in the presence of the B field. And so if momentum P and K combine into momentum P plus K, there's a little extra bit of world sheet that they have to pass through. And because of the magnetic field, there is an additional phase that the propagation amplitude picks up, which is simply the proportional to e to the I times the flux passing through that bit of world sheet area. So if we go substitute from the fact that the length of the strings is B inverse times the momentum, the area, that flux is simply this quantity. And so that leads us to a multiplication algebra of string fields, that the product of two string fields of momentum at momentum P and K is a string field at momentum P plus K times an additional phase, where the phase in the exponent is proportional to the inverse of the magnetic field. Now, a useful way of realizing that algebra is to remember your elementary quantum mechanics, that if I have a coordinate and its conjugate momentum commuting to h-bar, which in this case we'll call theta, then the generalized Weyl operators, exponentials of I times linear combinations of positions and momenta, obey this same algebra, that is U alpha U beta is a phase times U alpha plus beta. And so we have a one-to-one correspondence between this algebra of string fields in this large B limit and operator multiplication in ordinary quantum mechanics. That is, I can decompose any function of position and momenta in some ordering prescription as a linear combination of these Weyl exponentials. So low-energy open string dynamics in this large magnetic field limit is a gauge theory, because the strings are coupling to an external gauge field, plus tachyons if we have unstable brains. But now the fields are functions of a space of non-commutative coordinates. Okay, and so the algebra of continuous functions on space-time gets replaced by an operator algebra A, whose defining relation is this canonical commutation relation. So covariant derivatives, now we can replace the derivative operator by an equivalent expression in terms of the coordinates, because their commutation relations will be the same. And we can write down an action, the usual action for open strings. I've included a tachyon field in the case of that we have an unstable brain. And so the low energy Lagrangian is just a kinetic term for the tachyon plus some potential for it and some kinetic energy for the gauge field, and then again multiplied kinetic terms by some to be determined functions of the light scalar field in the problem. And integration over the world sheet now should be reinterpreted in terms of this quantum mechanics that realizes the non-commutative algebra, that's the algebra of the replacement for the algebra of functions, and integration then should just be interpreted as some proportionality factor times the trace over some representation of those commutation relations. So operator, the fields are elements of this operator algebra, and so we should just interpret this as a action density as some product of operators, and integration then is required having those operators act in some representation and then taking a trace over the representation. And that's unique because these commutation relations have a unique representation. Now, it's gauge theory of a rather curious sort. The gauge symmetry of the problem is unitary transformations on this Hilbert space. That's clearly a symmetry of this action. And one can readily see from the form of the covariant derivative that a generalized gauge transformation takes the form of some unitary conjugation of the covariant derivative by any element in U of H. Now, a very pretty observation of Harvey, Krauss, and Larson, and I think similar observations were made by Gross and Nekrasov, is that invariance of the action, well, I should say covariance of the action, only requires, since the action density is just a product of fields, and all the fields and covariant derivatives transform in this way, then and since this integration is really a trace, then due to the cyclic symmetry and the order in which things are multiplied, we only need for the action that u bar u is equal to 1. Now, if we were in finite dimensions, that would also mean that u bar equals 1. But our symmetry is not a finite dimensional symmetry. It's unitary transformations in quantum mechanical Hilbert space, which is infinite dimensional. And u bar u equals 1 does not necessarily mean that u bar equals 1. So a simple example of that is to go to, if you like, holomorphic coordinates, which are essentially raising and lowering operators in the Hilbert space. And then a simple shift operator that bumps everything up by one level in the number basis has the property that multiplying the shift up operator times the shift down operator clearly gives me the Hilbert space back again. But going in the reverse direction drops the lowest state, or more generally, the kth power of the shift operator drops the first k states if I multiply in the quote wrong order.
Are there more general examples of this?
Sure. Basically, construct anything whose product is any projection operator in Hilbert space. It's one in. Whose product in one order is 1, and product in another order is any projection operator in Hilbert space. Since if we were in finite dimensions, these would be unitary transformations. They would be like isometries of a finite dimensional Hilbert space. These things are called partial isometries because there's, well, for obvious reasons. Okay. So we can take any trivial solution to the equations of motion, say the tachyon field equal to 1 at some arbitrarily chosen minimum of the tachyon potential, and the trivial kinetic operator, and do one of these almost gauge transformations, and one will get a non-trivial solution where the tachyon field is now its vacuum value plus a little shift due to a projection operator, and the covariant derivative operator is suitably modified. Now, if one evaluates the... getting completely disorganized here. If one evaluates the action or the energy of these solutions and looks at their fluctuation spectrum and so on, one sees that they're actually descriptions of D-brains. And the simplest way to see that is that we started with 9 plus 1 dimensional gauge theory, where space of functions on which that gauge theory lived was ordinary functions, say, in 7 plus 1 dimensions times this non-commutative plane described by these operators A and A dagger. So what we've done is that the additional piece of the solution, the tachyon field is 1 plus this projection operator. So the space that is in the image of that projection operator, we now have, in that space we have, that's described by that extra piece of the solution, that non-commutative algebra projected by this finite dimensional projection operator onto the first k levels of Hilbert space, times the functions, commuting functions on the rest of spacetime. And so this is our algebra of functions for the small fluctuations around the solution. But that's simply k by k matrices and times functions on 7 plus 1 dimensions. And since we started off with gauge theory plus tachyons, then we get 7 plus 1 dimensional UK gauge theory, because this is just the Chan-Payton, if you like, the Chan-Payton space of K D7 brains. And it's relatively straightforward to see the moduli space of those D7 brains. Our simplest solution that we wrote down was one where we took this simplest shift operator that bumps us up K levels in the Hilbert space. A simple operator expression for simple operatic expression for that operator is this in terms of the raising operators. That's not too difficult to convince yourself. Or equivalently, U bar is the same thing with annihilation operator on the right. And now if we ask how does this lowering operator get acted on by these vial operators or translation operators in the Hilbert space, conjugation by the sort of magnetic translation operators just shift the lowering operator by a constant. And so really the way you should think of this shift operator is that it describes KD brains which are sitting at Z equals zero, because A to the K is essentially the kth moment, if you like, of the Hilbert space around the coherent state sitting at Z equals zero. Or equivalently, if you like, if we take the standard ground state of the number operator basis, we act on it with this coherent state translation operator. It's a state which is where the annihilation operator has the eigenvalue z. So if the annihilation operator annihilates a state which is at z equals zero, then a translate annihilates annihilated by this operator. Okay, and so we can construct more general partial isometries by replacing the annihilation operator to the K by some polynomial in the annihilation operator. And so now if I ask what coherent states in the Hilbert space get annihilated by this operator, well, clearly the coherent state located at each ZI. Okay. And so this operator has a still has a k-dimensional kernel, but now instead of that operator being sort of the ground state and its first kz derivatives around the origin, it's several coherent states located at separated points. And so clearly the moduli space of such partial isometries that I can construct is just the moduli space of these parameters zi, and that's just the kth symmetric product of the plane. And so that is, of course, the right answer for what is the moduli space of K7 brands.
This might be a dumb question, but is the degree of this thing, the K, related to the Ramon-Ramon charge of the brains in a straightforward way? Like, is it obvious?
I wouldn't claim that it's obvious, but yes. If you like, there is an invariant of the algebra, which is trace. And so a rank K projection operator has value K for that invariant. Maybe if I have time at the end, I'll describe various generalizations of that to more complicated situations.
There was another of a monopole number, instant number, for this pecuniary rather the brain charge and Ramon-Ramon charge. Is that for you?
Yeah, if you maybe a better answer to your question, and maybe a little more lowbrow, is that in the commutative case, Witten and Horjava described D-brain charge as certain winding configurations of the tachyon field. And so in situations where there is a conserved Ramon-Ramon charge, Harvey and Moore showed that there's a non-commutative analog of this tachyon winding number, and showed that it reduces to the commutative answer. So yes, it is Ramon-Ramon charge. Okay. In whatever time I have remaining, which fortunately I think will be enough, what one would like to do is to, I mean, we think we understand what D-brains are on flat space. What we would like to do is to come up with a somewhat more general story of what D-brains are as solitons on more general space-times. And in this sort of approach, the natural guess is that more complicated space-times are simply described by more complicated non-commutative algebras. So we would also like to believe that such algebras come out as low-energy limits of string theory in large magnetic fields. And so not to sort of go wildly off and start thinking about bizarre C-star algebras, perhaps it would be simplest to look to make contact with situations where we know how to do string theory and space is curved, namely orbifolds, or where there's non-trivial topology like string theory on a torus. And of course, the torus is just the orbifold of the plane by group of translations, a lattice of translations. So once we understand how orbifolds work, we understand how tori work. So the first, yes?
D-brains as solitons, are they solitons? Because I didn't see any Lorentzian signature in the starting point. So is it the instanton analog, or really soliton?
It's really a soliton. So what I did was to say, let's, for simplicity, I just described the simplest situation where we say, let's keep all the two of coordinates of space-time to be ordinary commutative coordinates and put this non-commutative structure on two spatial directions. Okay, those end up being in what I described, the spatial directions transverse to the soliton you end up constructing. So the idea is that this Hilbert space is coding the structure of the plane. Okay, and what it essentially does is that the non-commutativity parameter theta is like the size of a phase space cell in quantum mechanics. So what you've done is you split the plane up into little phase space cells, which are of the size of the non-commutativity. And a projection operator then puts you onto one of those, projects you onto one state in the Hilbert space, namely one phase space cell. So you've sort of described some localized lump, and which is the D-brain, and then the vacuum outside. So the tachyon, if you remember the tachyon configuration I had, was one, which was the vacuum solution, plus this projection operator. And so that describes a situation where you have one, namely the vacuum, what Wadi talked about as the stable closed string vacuum, everywhere except where the projection operator puts you, which is some localized lump, which is the D-brain. I'm sorry, I should have made that clearer at the beginning. Okay. So, question is, well, okay, we're going to describe now D-brains as solitons on orbifolds. What is it that we're trying to reproduce? That is, what do we know about D-brains on orbifolds? Well, the simplest sort of orbifold that one can think of is to take this plane that we've just discussed and orbifold it by some subgroup of rotations, say, fixing the origin. And then the simplest way to put D-brains on that space is, well, if we've identified the plane under some discrete rotation, if we just put one D-brain on each leaf of the covering space, which is our original plane, then obviously such a configuration will be invariant under the projection, under the symmetry action, and that will describe some sort of D-brain that lives on the orbifold. And there are more complicated generalizations that we'll get to in a moment. So essentially what we're going to demand is that the tachyon field is invariant under, is a scalar field, and so it should just be simply invariant under the subgroup of discrete rotations. And so this situation in the non-commutative language says that we should simply construct the tachyon field to be some partial isometry, built out of some partial isometry. And now where we pick those, reason we talked about the moduli space for a reason, because now we can just pick the point Zi where we locate the brains to be images of any given point under some orbit of the symmetry group we're quotienting by. So we should translate all of that into our operator language that describes the functions on the space. So what does it mean to have an orbifold? It means this operator algebra has an action of the symmetry group. That is, there's some homomorphism in fancy language of the group of symmetries into the the operator algebra. We have to, as before, in order to define the action as some trace over a representation, we have to have a representation of the algebra, which is just the same Hilbert space action we had before. We need a representation of the symmetry group as unitary transformations in that Hilbert space. And these all three of these things have to be compatible with each other, so that if we act with the representation, if we conjugate the representation of the algebra element A by the symmetry, the representation of the symmetry action, then we get the representation of the image of the algebra element under the automorphism that we had in step one. So that structure is known in the mathematics literature as a cross-product algebra. Simply put, if I take some basis for look at the I running over elements of the group gamma, then a general element of this algebra is simply formal sum of group elements with coefficients in the operator A, algebra big A. This multiplication law is simply the statement that if I multiply two such arbitrary elements, in bringing this group element through this algebra element, it gets conjugated by the automorphism action. Okay. So actually, this is just a baby version of what we've known in string theory all along is what it means to take an orbifold. That is, in string theory, when you take an orbifold, you don't make the algebra of string coordinates smaller. Rather, you add all of the twisted sectors. So you make actually the algebra of vertex operators bigger, and then out of that big algebra, you truncate it onto the states that are G invariant. And so this is the open string version of that, or it's a large B limit. So the Hilbert space on which the algebra acts now should break up into sectors because there's an action of the group by unitaries. And so it has to, in general, break up into some direct sum of representations, if you like. Each H row is isomorphic to some sum of an infinite number of copies of representation row of the group. And now a D-brain soliton, just as before, is a projection operator in the Hilbert space, and it lives on the orbifold if it survives the group projection, that is, if it's invariant under the action of the group. So we simply need to write down tachyon fields, which are, again, 1 minus some projection operator, and that projection operator has to be a sum over projection operators in these invariant subspaces.
What would be a fractional brain?
This includes all fractional brains, as you'll see in a minute. If we if we work in units where a rank k projection operator gives a collection of k d brains of total mass some constant over g string times k before the orbifold, then if that projection operator survives orbifolding, what it simply does is it breaks up this K into its components in the various irreducible components of the Hilbert space. So we can rewrite that as a sum over representations of the number of each of those representations that gets projected onto times the dimension of the representation. And so in particular, the first brain that we drew, the one where we have a copy of each a copy of a brain on each leaf of the covering space, is what is sometimes called a regular representation brain. That is, the k there is the order of the group, because I have a brain at each image point of a point on the plane under the action of the group. Okay, and so there are clearly more general projectors here, because the regular representation breaks up into one copy each of each irreducible. But nothing said that we had to pick one copy of each irreducible. We could have picked, say, one copy of representation row and zero copies of every other representation. And those are the fractional brains. So to make this a little less abstract, let's go back to our two-dimensional plane. And as I said, the raising and lowering operators were essentially like holomorphic coordinates in the non-commutative plane, and so they transform under rotation as holomorphic coordinates will. And in the Hilbert space, just being built on the nth power of the raising operator, just transforms in the obvious way. And so the invariant subspaces, then, if our group has, if it's Zn, are just the elements of the Hilbert space where the number is R mod n. Okay, so those are, and so if you like, J labels the infinite number of copies of that particular irreducible in the Hilbert space, and R labels which invariant representation we have. And so we can just project onto the first, say, the first n sub R states in each representation R, and that's a fractional brain, generally a fractional brain, with labels n sub R from R equals 0 to n minus 1. And one can indeed check then that if one writes the tachyon field as its vacuum value plus a fluctuation, and similarly expands the gauge field, that this gives the correct low energy dynamics of open string fluctuations around that collection of fractional brains. And as I said, if we put all of the n sub rho equal to k, then we get k, in this case k equals 3, brains of this most naive type. So now that we've understood the simplest case, let's move to the torus. And the torus represents another level of complication because on the torus, string theory has t-duality. And if we put d-brains on the torus, if they're point-like brains, then the number of image brains, rather than being the order of the group, if you like, is infinite. So if we're labeling brains by leaves of the covering space, we have to have that level of complication. So, as I said before, we're familiar in the commutative case with thinking of the torus as the quotient of the plane by a lattice of translations. So we should see that the same thing is true in this fancy language of the non-commutative plane. So let's again let curly A be the algebra of the non-commutative plane. And now let's call the lattice of translations have elements GMN, labeling which particular linear combination of basis vectors of the lattice describe the translation. So the automorphism by GMN of the operator algebra is simply conjugating it by a magnetic translation for that lattice point. And then again, remember O was some linear combination of these basis viel operators, and the magnetic translation is just the exponential operator itself. So it's pretty clear then that invariant operators are spanned by the dual lattice linear combinations, integer linear combinations of some omega prime basis elements, which bear this simple relation to our original spatial lattice of identifications, then the phase that I generate here is some multiple of 2 pi. And so invariant operators are some sums over p and q of some coefficients times appropriate dual lattice exponentials. The Hilbert space is still infinite dimensional.
Is that because the torus is incommensurate?
In the general case, Well, there's nothing in what I described that requires theta particular to be a rational number. However, the representation theory is rather degenerate when theta is rational. So for the purposes of this talk, I think I would like to keep theta irrational, just
but
so that I didn't have that problem.
It wouldn't become finite dimensional if the number of cells...
Then the original... Right, the original Hilbert space, then... I mean, I still have an infinite dimensional Hilbert space. All I've done is, if you like, tacked on a copy of... you know, taking this cross product, tacked on a copy of z squared. It's just that itself will now break up into an infinite number of infinitely reducible set of copies of irreps of this algebra. Okay. So invariant operators, if you like, I've just rewritten what was on the previous transparency. If I define U and V to be the generators, big U and big V to be the generators along the basis directions omega 1 prime and omega 2 prime, then the invariant operators are simple combinations of those basis elements. Okay, and so these basis elements U and V, which are exponentials of omega prime times A, are generating translations on the dual lattice to the original identification of the non-commutative plane. So they're really operators that translate you in the momentum space of that non-commutative plane. And that algebra is uniquely characterized, well, not uniquely characterized, it's characterized by the discrete magnetic translation algebra of this form, and which, as you can see, becomes somewhat degenerate if theta is rational. Okay. Now, there's a form of T-duality on algebras of this type known as Morita equivalence. T-duality in string theory is actually an equivalence relation on vertex operators. It's an isomorphism of vertex operator algebras. It says that vertex operator algebra for closed strings on a circle of radius r is the same algebra as closed strings on a circle of radius 1 over r. Here you don't have something quite that strong, because we've taken some limit, some low energy limit of string theory, so we don't have the full vertex operator algebra. But what you do have is something called Morita equivalence, which says that two algebras defined by this relation have the same representation theory. So it's not that the algebras are isomorphic, it's that they have isomorphic representation theories. If the defining parameters theta and theta prime are related by a fractional linear transformation. So that's a good thing. Because suppose we have a projection operator in the algebra, for instance, representing a D7 brain on the torus, then since the D7 is a T-dual to a D9 brain, then what are we saying? We're saying that, remember, the projection operator sort of projects you down onto the Chan-Peyton space of the lower dimensional brain. That was certainly the what was happening in the previous examples. But that has to be some algebra that, if I do a T-duality transformation, is the original 9-brain algebra. So one can, in fact, prove that this is true, and I refer you to the paper with Greg Moore for a simple argument. Using just basic facts about these algebras A theta. Namely, that any projection operator in the algebra has the property that if we conjugate the algebra by the projection operator, that that is isomorphic to some matrix algebra over A theta prime, where theta prime is fractional linear related, is Morita equivalent to A theta. So that's good, because basically what's happening is that the z-squared in these two algebras, one of them describes the lattice of momenta on the nine-brain, and the other z-squared in the algebra A theta prime is describing the z-squared worth of images of the seven-brain on the torus. Now, these projection operators are somewhat funny beasts. Let me give an example, which is due to the mathematician Mark Riefel and been noted by a number of people in the physics application. Let's let f be some periodic function which rises smoothly. So let's let theta be between a half and one, just for the sake of argument. And let f be some function which rises smoothly to one at the point one minus theta, stays at one, and then goes back down to zero. And let g be a function which is simply related to f. Using the defining relation of the algebra, one can then show that the following linear combination of functions in the algebra is a projection operator. And moreover, that the image algebra under the projection is the T-dual algebra. So, as an example, as a simplest example of what you need to show, notice that this projection operator is polynomial, is just trilinear in U, so it's sort of tridiagonal in the U direction. And so, in particular, you have to worry that when you take P squared, there are going to be terms here that go like U squared. So how can this thing be square to itself? Well, the point is that if you look at that term, you have to take this U through this G of V, and by the magnetic translation algebra, that shifts the argument. And then this function was precisely cooked up so that it multiplied by it evaluated at discrete translation is identically zero. Okay. And similarly, for the other terms, that the functional relations that you need to satisfy are appropriate so that p squares to itself. I should say that this particular projection operator is not the square of some partial isometry. So it's not a solution to the equations of motion. All we can say is that it's in the same topological class as a solution to the equations of motion. So there is a solution which carries those Ramon-Rowan charges. And finally, one more point, and I seem to be coming to the conclusion a little bit ahead of time, is that this projection operator that we wrote down is invariant under the operation of complex conjugation, that is, U goes to U inverse and V goes to V inverse. And so it respects a certain Z2 symmetry that if this were a commutative situation would just be the standard T2 mod Z2 orbifold, whose fixed points would be at these half points of the torus. And so in the commutative case, there would be, as a basis for the lattice of D-brain charges, the D-brain wrapping the whole torus, the zero-brain on the torus, and then D-brains wrapping the fixed points. one of each. On the other hand, now in the non-commutative operator algebra language, there are the following independent basis elements of the algebra of projection operators, namely the identity operator, which is just the original D9 brain, the projection operator P from the last transparency, which describes a D7 brain, and then projection operators onto the various invariant subspaces of the Hilbert space. This one is, if you like, gamma is the Z2 operation. If we just describe the Hilbert space ordinarily, this is just the projection operator onto one of the Z2 eigenvalues. But then this is another operator that squares to 1. So this is a projection operator which turns out is not unitarily equivalent to this one, and so on. And it's clear from, if this were a commutative situation, what would this element be? It would be translate in the U direction and then reflect. That has a fixed point, which is this point, whereas this has a fixed point, which is this point. So it's pretty clear what these things are doing. They're projection operators which are describing fractional brains that are located at any of the fixed points of the torus. Since I have a little bit of extra time, let me just close with an observation of that will hopefully be contained in work to be published sometime. That is, you might ask, what then characterizes, in general, the sets of brains that you construct this way? And actually, it is kind of a nice story. One knows from the work of Manasian and Moore and Witten and Horjava that D-brain charges are classified by K-theory. On the other hand, we're often used to thinking about D-brain charges in terms of cohomology theory. That is, when we describe Ramon-Ramon charges, we describe them as P-forms in smooth geometries. And what we're really saying is that there's a pairing between K-theory and homology. Okay, simplest example of this is the Dirac index. Okay, the Dirac index is a K-theory invariant. However, we write an integral form for it in terms of the A-roof genus, which is a cohomological invariant. And so there's a map between K-theory and cohomology. Now, mathematicians have been... Yes?
Sorry, but that map's not isomorphism, right? I mean, there's cases where they disagree,
I'm talking here about the non-torsion component. Okay. Let's not make life too difficult. Mathematicians were rather puzzled by when Dixon, Harvey, Vaffa, and Witten came up with this formula for the cohomology of an orbifold, in particular how what's the Euler character of the fixed point sets and so on. And a little bit later, T and Siegel showed that was actually a formula for the K theory of the torus. Of the orbifold. And however, it's a little bit singular or degenerate to say what the cohomology of that thing is. I mean, string theory provides you a definition, if you like, of what the cohomology is. But actually, in work with Greg Moore, what we were able to show is that if you work in the non-commutative setting, that there's a very nice definition of cohomology theory of non-commutative algebras, defined by Kahn, and that one can exhibit a complete set of invariants of the algebra, which are in one-to-one correspondence with the D-brain charges. So I think the answer to the mathematician's question what is the relation between the physicist's formula for the cohomology of the orbifold and the K-theory, one should really work in the non-commutative setting and define what's called the cyclic cohomology of the orbifold of the cross-product algebra. And the cyclic cohomology of the cross-product algebra is the proper setting in which to understand the relation between cohomology and K-theory. And what we were able to do was to construct a complete set of essentially invariant twisted traces, the analogs of invariants of twisted sectors that characterize the K-theory invariants of the orbifold. So let me stop there.